This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Laurent Richard, who, along with Sandrine Rigaud, wrote Pegasus, How a Spy in Your Pocket Threatens the End of Privacy, Dignity, and Democracy. In the book, the two investigative journalists detail how they came to discover the use and abuse of a new technology at the heart of modern surveillance and spying. Laurent, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. This was an extremely terrifying book, so thank you for giving me nightmares. Before jumping into it, I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
I'm a French journalist based in Paris. I'm 46 years old. I'm running an organization that I founded 5 years ago called Forbidden Stories, and our main mission is to continue the work of assassinated or other threats or jail reporters to make sure that people will get access to the information, the stories people were silenced for. And so I'm an investigative reporter for the past 25 years. Most of my work was to direct some investigative documentaries, mostly for French public TV, but also for other kind of foreign platform or channels, long form documentaries on complex stories, and I've done a lot of report abroad, sometimes in countries where freedom of the press were not that that real. So I founded Forbidden Stories 5 years ago with this idea that's very simple idea that every time a journalist is killed, we should team up to continue his work and make sure we can send a strong signal to enemies of the free press that even if you kill the messenger, you will never kill the message.
Was there any particular event or a series of events that led you to thinking that something like Forbidden Stories should exist?
Yeah, that's a combination of experience in some countries where I was sometimes reporting, for instance, in Azerbaijan, which is a dictatorship, where I was investigating some stories about corruption. And for the same kind of stories, local journalists were jailed. So I started thinking at that time how, as a journalist coming from a democracy, we can let the others benefit from our press freedom, and how by collaborating and by asking the question that others can no longer ask because they have been jailed for that or because they might be jailed for that, how we can amplify the stories some people wanted to silence. But what happened, another thing that happened in my life really changed my perception of what I should do as a journalist and gave me some strength to think about a new step in my life. It's what happened on January 2015. On that day, two terrorists from Al-Qaeda of Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, decided to attack the Charlie Hebdo newsroom. And the Charlie Hebdo newsroom was the neighbor was sharing the same floor than my previous company, Premier Line. And that day I arrived right after the attack, maybe 2 minutes after the terrorists escaped the building, and I was amongst the first who were arriving on the scene, and with other colleagues and friends, we tried to help the people who survived and identify the people who were dead. And so that event and that all that violence, this terrorist attack against people who were doing the same kind of job than me, they were reporters or cartoonists, after that, I really start thinking about what I can do after that, or what I should do as a journalist, and what we should do as a journalist to keep stories alive. And this is how I got this idea about I should create an international organization devoted to continuing the work of assassinated reporters. And this is how I start Forbidden Stories.
This book was written by you and your co-author, Sandrine, but could you give the audience a little bit of an impression of how many people worked on this project and, you know, what it actually was that led to the investigation of the NSO group?
Yeah, so that's collaborative work. More than 80 reporters worked for that project called Pegasus Project for a year. The goal of this project was to investigate a spyware called Pegasus. And Pegasus is the name of the spyware that is sold by a company that is called the NSO Group, based in Israel, a private company selling a spyware to state actors. Officially, this spyware is only sold to state actors to fight against terrorism, to catch criminals, to catch very bad guys. The beginning of the Pegasus project was when we at Forbidden Stories and with Amnesty International, the two organizations, we were both granted access to a huge leak, a leak of 50,000 phone numbers who were phone numbers of person potentially targeted by this spyware, the Pegasus spyware. And so we were at the beginning having 50,000 phone numbers from all around the world in many countries, from so many citizens, many phone numbers, many international area code. And those persons, some of them were targeted, some of them were just person of interest, numbers who were entered into the NSO system. And the very first step was to identify the numbers, who was behind those numbers, because we were having in our hand a historical leak, a document that can tell you who is spying on who all over the world. And from more than 10 states like Saudi Arabia, Azerbaijan, Mexico, states who are very well known for having very bad track records in terms of human rights violation. So this is how the project started.
And you mentioned that the NSO Group is a private company based in Israel. You know, is Pegasus the main product? What exactly is Pegasus? And, you know, why did the NSO Group decide to produce this spyware?
So Pegasus is one of the spyware that is currently used by different states to spy officially on terrorists, to prevent terrorist attack, to catch the criminals. In reality, we were able to observe a broad misuse of the spyware. We discovered through the list that the spyware were used against journalists, against lawyers, political opponents, dissidents, people who were not terrorists, people who were not criminals. So this company, NSO, is a leader of the cyber surveillance in the world. Is a startup based in Israel, which is a country that is for the past years have been a long time pioneer in this area of cyber surveillance, and that company, the NSO Group, really was able to produce one of the most sophisticated spyware that country have been able to use. This spyware can activate your camera. This spyware can read your encrypted messages. This spyware can give you so many information about your target. Basically, the spyware is taking entirely the control of your device without you knowing that. That's what we call a zero-click infection. You don't know that you are the victim. You're already the victim. The spyware is running on into your device, and it's collecting all your information, transferring all your personal information, videos, photos, emails, password, messages to people who are surveilling you. So for basically intelligence units working from state who are the NSO customers. And that kind of information might used against you at some point one day.
Who are some of the customers of NSO? I imagine you were able to find some of that out, and I'm sure some of it was also hard to pinpoint.
Yeah, the NSO is having more than 40 customers around the world, which they sell to the Pegasus spyware. So many states, including in the European Union, you have many European countries who are using both the spyware. The thing is more about who you want to, the who you are able to sell the spyware to. When you start selling the spyware to countries like Saudi Arabia or Mexico, where you know there is a very high level of corruption, Saudi Arabia was able to kill some journalists in some consulate, or Azerbaijan, who is tracking the dissidents all around the world. You know from the beginning how it will hurt, and you know that there would be some misuse of the technology you are selling to. So during that Pegasus project, with 80 reporters, we were not only investigating a company, but more than 10 states and quite dangerous states who are spending millions to surveil people, so including ourselves. So we didn't want, the only thing we didn't want was to be the next one on the list. So we tried as much as we can to stay under the radar and to communicate with the very safe communication channels within the group, so we can work as a journalist efficiently.
Can you describe how you managed to ensure that 80 people didn't get hacked during the investigation? Because I imagine by just participating in this, you were putting targets on yourselves.
Yeah, it was quite challenging because some of our partners actually have been already targeted, and when we got access to the list, we saw immediately that some people we were working with were on that list. So we were in the middle of the COVID crisis, so it was difficult to call the people. And of course, you don't want to call someone that is under surveillance because you know that you will be surveilled during your conversation. So we found ways to meet person in person, physically. So this is how we did that. And then Amnesty International Security Lab was more than a strong partner in that collaboration, was able to invent and create a very sophisticated and secure communication protocol for the 80 reporters that I cannot describe precisely, of course, but it was a way for us to stay under the radar as much as we can. And of course, it was challenging because we are just journalists. So we need to, one of the very important steps was to reach out to people that we were seeing on the list, we were seeing their phone numbers. So we were reaching out to them, telling them that without revealing the nature or the scope of the investigation, that we were having reasons to believe that they were surveilled and that we needed from them their device to make some forensic analysis. And to convince them to do that was quite tricky, because it's not that easy to give your device to 80 reporters. So we did well. We get a lot of success in making a lot of analysis of a lot of device, and we found traces of infection, which was really one of the key thing of the project. Was Amnesty International Security Lab, with their own expertise, was able to find traces of infection to prove what happened and to prove that those people were real victim of that cyber surveillance.
You've mentioned a couple of countries that were purchasers of the NSO group's Pegasus software. How does the NSO group decide who to sell it to? Like, I imagine that the Israeli government probably has some say in who they're allowed to sell to. Was there any sense of concern on behalf of the Israeli government about some of the customers?
Yeah, so it's true that the Pegasus spyware is considered by the Ministry of Defense as a weapon. So it's a military weapon, basically used against civilians. So the company NSO has to get the green light of the Ministry of Defense of Israel to make any kind of contract with any kind of state actors. So when NSO was able to sell the spyware to Saudi Arabia, it was with the green light of the government of Israel. So this raised a lot of questions. We understood that at some point as well, NSO was used by the government of Israel as a tool when Benjamin Netanyahu was visiting some countries and visiting other head of states. He was proposing them to sign a contract with the Israeli company NSO Group and to sell them so they can use the Israeli spyware. But they were, on the other end, the NSO always pretend to have a kind of ethics committee to see and to make some due diligence about some countries before making a contract. But this is really where NSO is not transparent at all. They are not transparent at all about who their customers are. They are not really transparent about what is the due diligence process. And if you do some due diligence process, how is it possible to sign a contract with Saudi Arabia? So that's a lot of question that finally we don't have really answers from NSO, because NSO didn't really answer to that kind of question, even during the investigation done by the European Parliament during the investigative committee.
During the whole investigation, what would you say for you personally was the biggest surprise?
The very first thing that was very surprising for me and was very scary was the scale of the misuse, the scale of the threat against democracies, against global democracies. Many countries at the same time using exactly the same spyware sold by a private company without any kind of accountability, transparency, lying to citizens, targeting them, and getting from the citizens many information at the same time to make sure that they won't publish their stories if they are journalists, make sure that you will identify the sources of a journalist, make sure that you can silence a dissident. So this is a perfect tool for tyrants. That was for me what was really surprising is the global pattern behind that and the global impunity as well. We're talking about something that there is no mechanism to protect you. You don't know that you're a target, even if you know that. You can try to sue NSO, but you need to have some lawyers suing them in Israel. You can try to sue a government, but they will deny using NSO. You can try to sue Apple, who was selling you the device that was infected, but it's going to be very difficult. So there is no real mechanism so far to seek justice.
What was the overall result of the investigation, if you were to sort of summarize the main findings?
Yeah, when we published the Pegasus project, this had a big impact all over the world. And this made the headlines of many newspapers, not only newspapers from our consortium, but outside the consortium. So we were having like the French president asking the Ministry of Defense of Israel to come immediately to France to explain, to give some reasons about the context and to give explanation. The Supreme Court of India was launching an investigation. At the European level, all the European countries both decide to start a parliamentary committee to investigate those abuses. In the US, Department of Defense decide to blacklist the NSO group and make sure that a company based in the US will no longer be able to contract with the NSO group. Apple decided to sue NSO after our publication as well, and to notify any single customers all around the world when Apple is suspecting a state to attack one of their customers. So, yeah, it made a lot of impact, and I think now the company NSO has the CEO resigned as well. So, yeah, there many impact happened, many things happened after the revelation.
And as of today, what do you sort of see as the future of the NSO group and just the future of surveillance companies, cyber surveillance companies in general?
The question is not about really NSO Pegasus in that story, because you have one NSO that you know, but you have all 10 other NSO that you really don't know the name yet, but they are still in the place. They are already selling their spyware, and NSO was the most well-known. But this industry is very resilient. And this is a very lucrative business as well. You have tyrants, dictatorship ready to pay millions and to give you millions because you can sell them spyware, a way for them to get information. So we have to be concerned about the future, because so far there is no regulation, no legislation, nothing to protect us. There is a lot on the other end. You have a lot of countries ready to pay millions to buy that kind of spyware. So this is where we are. So this is why we should all be concerned and ask our politicians to build some regulation to protect all of us, or to make sure that they can be at least a little bit more transparent with who is using the Pegasus. If you use Pegasus, who is controlling the way you're using Pegasus? And if you sell Pegasus as a spy, because you're a spyware company or cyber surveillance company, you should be questioned about what kind of country you are selling to.
And as far as Israel is concerned, you mentioned that, you know, Israel's industry of cyber surveillance is very advanced compared to other countries. And you mentioned that the defense minister went in to give an explanation to Macron. What's been their sort of response and reaction to this? Have they just tried to downplay it, or they made the case that, you know, these sorts of technologies are necessary for security?
I think, of course, those kind of technology could be necessary to prevent terrorist attack. And we should not be naive. The French government, even if they didn't buy NSO Pegasus, so they have their own Pegasus themselves. So I think that in Israel, they are really the champion of cyber surveillance because they it was for them a priority at some point from the past 7 or 8 years to become the leader in that. They are able to look at some 12, 13 years old boy or girls and to see from who is the best in hacking, in coding, in programming, and to make sure that they can have a lot of people joining their military, cyber military unit later on. And then those people, we get a lot of money by working for a company like NSO. So in Israel, they did react without transparency. We don't know exactly what was the decision. I think that they understand that there was a kind of it was a damaging for the reputation of Israel as well, that kind of scandal when you have one private actor able to do that kind of contract with that kind of countries without preventing those misuse. But yes, we don't know much more about how Israel precisely react after that.
And what is the future for Forbidden Stories? You know, other projects. I'm sure you can't speak about current investigations necessarily, but you know, the general future for Forbidden Stories.
Yeah, I think it's our main mission is to continue the work of Assassinated and the Threat and Jail Reporters, and so we have a lot to do because many journalists get killed every year. Our future is there because there is a need for that. Our way to think is to think as well, the killer of the journalists, they don't care too much about the statement. They care much more about having their own crimes exposed in the newspapers all over the world. So this is how we try to disrupt their businesses by publishing the stories they wanted to silence. And in that case, collaboration makes sense because it doesn't make sense to kill reporters if you know that 50 others are ready to carry on his work. So this is what we are doing. And I really think, since your question is about the future, I really think that the future is collaboration between journalists regarding journalism. Collaborative journalism is really the future of journalism because you have it brings protection, it brings resources, it brings more impact and more information because you have 80 journalists who are that are fact-checking any single word, any single sentence, any single quotes in your article, in your piece at the end. So this is why I think we should all believe in that kind of collaboration.
Yeah, the book is definitely a testament to that. And you know, the fact that 80 people worked on this project is pretty remarkable. You know, it's truly like a feat that you managed to accomplish that. Well, Laurent, thank you so much for being a guest in the New Books.
Thank you, Caleb.
Great to talk with you. You know, just to end it off, you know, if any listeners are interested in following up on the work that you are doing, you know, if there's a place that they can find what you're doing, whether it's Forbidden Stories website or somewhere else, where might they go?
Yeah, on forbiddenstories.org, you can follow us. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Caleb. And then